Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, May 6th, 2024, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
And I'm Guy Yero, and this week we're talking about one of America's fantastic flat fishes, the southern flounder.
And I'm pleased to introduce our guests. Daniel Kemp is a marine biology PhD student at Texas A&M University at Galveston. Daniel is also a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service volunteer who writes fish stories for us. We also have Mark Fisher. We love that last name, Mark. Mark is the science director for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Coastal Fisheries Division. So welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so southern flounder. Say I have this fish in my hand. I'm not familiar with flounder at all. What would I see and how would it feel in my hands?
Well, first thing you would notice is that the eyes are on the left side of the fish.
Okay.
And an impressive mouthful of teeth.
I was noticing their teeth. They're kind of like conical and quite bigger than I had expected. They're a little intimidating looking. That's cool.
Well, the worst fish bite I ever received was from a flounder. I caught him and I was trying to unhook him and I was being careless. And he reminded me that I was careless.
Gotcha.
She reminded me that I get that straight. It was not a male.
Okay. Gotcha. Anything else about their appearance that's cool to key in on, I guess?
Well, so the obvious thing is that they're going to be a flatfish. So like Mark said, both eyes on the same side of the head. They're going to be pretty mottled brown with some spots of there. There's, at least where I grew up in West Florida, it's mostly the Gulf flounder. But occasionally, once you get a little further north, you get into the southern flounder. And main way to differentiate them besides the size is the Gulf flounder have this distinct triangle of spots on their colored side, whereas the southern flounder are kind of just more evenly mottled throughout.
Adult flounder have their pigmentation on one side and they're white on the downside. But every now and then, it's very unusual, they will retain the pigmentation on their downside.
That is interesting. And up into Georgia and the Carolinas, we also get the summer flounder. How do you distinguish that from southern?
That's easy because we don't have them in the Western Gulf.
Yep.
Fair enough. Know where you are.
You go. I always kind of wonder what it would be like to be a flatfish when that eye starts to migrate over to the other side. I mean, that's a pretty unique process for a fish. They're having a lot of changes from when they're a juvenile to when they become an adult. And I'm wondering if either of you can speak to that.
They start the transition after about 6 weeks of age. They begin life as just a regular larval fish. Eyes on both sides of the head. And then as they get around 6 weeks or so, the eye starts moving, the right eye starts moving over to the left side. And by the time they're almost 1 inch, they look just like a regular adult flounder, except they're just 1 inch long. And that's when they change from swimming in the water column to laying on the bay floor, just like an adult.
Does that color change happen at that same time too, where they got that mottled side on the top and then the light on the bottom?
I'm mostly working with the larval stage as they're developing, both before, during, and slightly after that transition around 6 weeks. But over the course of about 3 to 5 days is how fast that transition happens. So it's quite a bit faster than I sort of initially expected when I was kind of first learning about the fish. And I got one photo of some of my specimens with one of the eyes is like sort of like partway between. It's not quite fully migrated yet.
What prompts that change? Is it something physiological or what's causing them to make that change at that time period?
It's, from what I understand, is mostly a hormone thing, dependent on the surge in a few thyroid hormones. That's more a question for someone else working in my lab. But it does depend somewhat, at least, on a few other physiological factors that I am currently studying, possibly metabolic rate, possibly food availability.
So we're talking about this really interesting life history of this fish that starts out looking like a normal fish and then just changes its morphology drastically. I have to assume those two different life stages, they're associated with different habitats and different ecologies completely. So what is the life cycle of a flounder? If you're starting off as an egg at a mating event, at a spawning event, and then transitioning through adulthood, what would that look like?
Well, they spawn offshore in the Gulf, in the open Gulf, in 50 to 100 feet of water. That happens in late fall, early winter. And then through combination of tides and currents, the larvae will drift and otherwise work their way into our bays, starting around January or so. And that's where they'll spend the next years and days growing and eating and living till they become sexually mature, which would be about 2 years. Then the adults go back offshore to the Gulf. Spawning occurs around December, mid-December, late December or so. Okay. Pretty short event. And the whole process repeats itself.
When they're inshore, what kind of habitat are they in? Is this a salt marsh kind of habitat or more open? What's it like?
The sub-adults and large juveniles, they exist in the, well, open bay bottom. They're not really associated with anything. But the larger adults are common near the shoreline, sandy, muddy bottoms, and they blend in very well in that environment. You can catch them, especially like at the mouth of a tidal creek. They will lay in ambush at the mouth of a tidal creek and on a falling tide, as the bait and other bait fish come out of those creeks, the flounder will lie in wait and ambush them. There's lots of spartina along those tidal creeks, lots. It's just a nondescript looking tall grass. Not really all that green, more of a blue-green kind of a color to it.
Is it wavy like you imagine, like out on a prairie where it kind of rustles and stuff, or is it more kind of rigid?
Pretty rigid, and you don't see that many taller than, say, a foot or so.
Are there fish moving within that grass? That's spartina?
When the tide is high, yes. And that's a good hiding place for the killifish, but also grass shrimp and other things will be found in there. When the tide's really high, red drum will swim up into those flooded spartina flats. And they'll feed. You can hear them up in there feeding and thrashing about.
What do they sound like?
Just a large fish trying to push its way through the grass. And then they really do have to do that. You can actually see them at times. When the spartina is dense, you can watch and see the red pushing its way through the spartina.
That's cool. What other fish might we find in there? So we've got these flounder. We've got red drum. What are some of the other bigger species other than the killifish?
Black drum is another big one. There's relatively few large fish species that can really go up and live in a lot of those tidal creeks, especially the ones that are lower salinity. The sort of speckled trout that live throughout a lot of the bays don't usually like that lower salinity water.
Red drum are the most common I've seen up at the flooded spartina marshes.
Okay, since May is American Wetlands Month, we've invited a special correspondent from our National Wetlands Inventory, Amelia Bartnick, to pop in and join us real quick. And what you might not know is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is actually tasked with getting information to the public on the nation's wetland habitats and how they're changing over time, so how they're doing. Amelia, what is the latest?
Hey, well, we have been releasing a big wetlands report every 10 years for about 70 years, and our latest one just came out. It's definitely worth a read. It's taken a lot of work from our program. We found out that net wetland loss has increased by 50% over the past decade, primarily with vegetated wetlands like marshes and swamps being impacted the most. These wetlands are disappearing really quickly. 670,000 acres were lost, which is an area about the size of Rhode Island. Losing out on these wetlands can lead to the reduced health, safety, and prosperity of all Americans, as well as the decline of commercially, culturally, and recreationally valuable species. So if listeners do want to learn more about wetlands and how they can help, I would encourage them to check out the full report, which is on our website at fws.gov. And also, wetlands are just beautiful places to check out generally. You'll usually be able to see lots of birds and other cool wildlife, get some good photos, just a happy place to hang out. I loved hearing about how the southern flounder and the killifish and other fishes are using salt marsh wetlands in this episode, which is another super important type of wetland. So yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
If you're trying to either angle or otherwise catch flounder, how would you go about it?
There's two main methods, hook and line, which is a daytime fishery. And then there's gigging with a handheld spear.
And gigging is a very common way to catch them in Texas. A gig is basically like a three-pronged spear. You go out at night and sort of have these massive spotlights shining down. Without the light illuminating the bottom, it is real tough to pick them out.
During the daytime, live bait, of course, or dead bait fish on the bottom, because that's where the flounder are.
What kind of bait are folks using?
A like common one or? Is, they call them mud minnows here on the Texas coast, but those are Gulf killifish.
Okay.
Hmm.
A small live mullet's also one that I've seen quite a lot as well.
And shrimp as well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything
shrimp,
on the
okay.
bottom. It's got to okay. be on the bottom. To throw in top waters, you're going to be disappointed. My fly fishing friends would be really irritated if I don't mention that you can fly fish for flounder. What you need all is right. a weighted fly and the mouth of tidal creeks, and make sure that fly bounces off the bottom, because that's the only way you're going to catch them.
Nice. And how big a fly, I guess, are we talking like streamer pattern? Are you trying to make them look like a little shrimp, or what are people using?
Inch or two.
Okay.
There's a whole variety of patterns. So one where they imitate those plastic grubs. Have you seen the curly tail flies?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one works pretty well as long as it's weighted.
Kind of funny that curly tail grub is the standard, because up in your neck of the woods, Katrina, in Alaska, you know, I've seen those giant like 20-ounce jigs that people use for halibut with like the 8 or 9 inch curly tails.
Yep.
And then come down here and it's the same style lure, just scale model for
yeah.
the other flatfish.
Yeah, some heavy gear up here.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Now, one time I pulled up one of those, the halibut got off, but I still had half the jig left on it. And I gave it away. That fish had halibutosis. I tell you, it stunk. It was awful. I don't know what the oral hygiene of the southern flounder's like, but the Pacific halibut's nasty.
I will not be inspecting their teeth close enough to find out anytime soon, I think.
Mark's going to lose his nose next, giving it a sniff.
Yeah.
I will say I was pretty shocked by some of the stuff I saw when I first moved here and was doing some fishing in some of those tidal creeks and salt marshes, where I was going after a red drum. You know, it was shallow enough that I had to pull up the pedal drive for my kayak and sort of like scoot myself around with my like paddles and feet. You know, it was maybe 14 to 18 inches deep. And I saw something that I never thought I would see, which was flounder like jumping out of the water, pursuing some shrimp that were near the edges of the grass. That's the only time where I've seen like any kind of surface feeding from flounder before. That shocked me, seeing a flatfish just launch itself out of the water like that.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you're talking like 14 to 18 inches, how high up
right.
are they willing to come off the bottom normally to hit something? If you're in 8 feet of water or more, mm-hmm. imagine the bottom is somewhere like 2 feet and lower.
I mean, Galveston Bay is quite shallow. I think the average depth is somewhere around 3 feet
for
most of it. So there's not really many areas where you get to, you know, 8 feet of water for a lot of it. From what I've seen personally, the times that I've actually been able to see a flounder, like hit a lure, they're willing to come up a foot or two.
Okay. So I am curious, though, that you're talking about fishing these tidal creeks and having live bait. These fish, as Mark was saying, you know, they're ambush predators. How are you making sure that you're covering area so that you'll get in the face of these fish that are just sitting there?
You just fan out and cover lots of water.
Huh. Yeah, I was told by someone that knows a lot more about fishing here than I do, is just like, let your bait sit for about 5 minutes, then cast out, fan to a different area of water. A lot of the guys will basically fish small sort of curly tail grubs rigged on a tandem rig where there's sort of two lures on your line and reel them very slowly. So they're kind of just like just off the bottom.
Okay.
When you catch one of these fish, they've got these kind of aggressive looking teeth. How are you going about unhooking them without hurting yourself?
Mark.
No, I'm not a good one for that.
It does seem hard to handle, though. You know, it's not like you can either, yeah. Obviously you can't lip it like you would a bass, but in like a
right.
trout, you can't really get your hand around it.
You can kind of grip them behind the gill plates. I probably wouldn't recommend doing that if you're planning to release the fish, because, you know, it's a bit of a sensitive area, but you can kind of get a hard grip behind their gill plates and hold them decently. But for the most part, yeah, you kind of want to try to land them as soon as possible or get them into a net.
I'm going to ask my follow-up about gigging now. You're an well, I guess it's A&M Galveston. What? You guys aren't Aggies also, are you?
I think the technical term is Sea Aggies, but like, yeah, Aggies.
Okay. I was trying to make in a, you know, a gig-em reference or something. Horny toads aren't the only thing that can be gigged. You can also gig flounder. So we've kind of gotten a little bit of an idea of what gigging is. You're spearing the fish, but the actual nuts and bolts of how you go, but do you need a boat? Can you do it by wading? You said the bay's mostly like only 3 feet deep in most mm-hmm. spots. How do you see a fish? And then how do you make sure you preserve the meat as best you can when you're trying to spear it?
Sure. Bearing in mind, I've only gone gigging myself once. I'm more familiar with it but through just talking to people in the fishing community around here. So first thing to note is that you definitely can do it, wading or occasionally even from shore. A lot of times these flounder are not particularly skittish. I've released flounder from a kayak and seen them just go right back down to the bottom under me and just lay down there waiting. They're kind of like relying on their camouflage to keep them safe. That said, in a lot of those tidal creeks and those marshes, that mud is extremely deep. So you want to be very, very careful about where you are wading, because it's quite easy to sink in to a point where it is not easy to get yourself out.
There's a boot there.
Yeah. Could have worse happen, depending on how deep it gets. Most of the gigging boats that I see, and that's, to my knowledge, where most of the gigging happens is from those boats, are sort of these very wide, flat-bottom boats. And they sort of look unlike any other kind of fishing boat that you might see. They're like really, really wide, really flat. They don't really look like they're designed to go very fast, which indeed they're usually not as fast as some other ones. But they're able to float in very, very shallow water. And a lot of them are going to sort of be lined with these massive arrays of lights that are going to shine down into the water. This is usually going to be a nighttime fishery where you're sort of cruising these very shallow mud and sand flats out in the bays or at the mouths of tidal creeks or even up along some of that Spartina. And shining lights down into the water around you, trying to illuminate any flounders or other fish to spear. And I believe the usual method is to try and get them right behind the head, sort of like on the gill plates there, to make sure you're not stabbing right into the main meat of the fish.
Okay.
I'm thinking of a halibut. When we harpoon those, it's like they've got kind of that gut pocket up close near the head. And that's also an area to think about that doesn't have a bunch of the meat.
When you're scanning the bottom when you're going along, are you looking for the pattern of the fish? Or are you looking for a general shape disruption on the bottom? Are you looking for any sort of like light shadows that are thrown off? What gives it away that there's a flounder there?
Mostly the shape. A lot of times they're going to be a little darker than the surrounding bottom. But that said, a lot of times the water here in Texas is already somewhat like murky-ish brown. There's just a whole lot of silt coming in from the mouth of the Mississippi. You get much clearer water more to the south. Usually it's going to be the shape, yeah. You see sort of this diamond-looking thing down in the water, and then if you, you get a closer look, oftentimes you can pick out some of the fins or eyes or something like that.
Okay, nice. What's a good night of gigging? How many fish can you bring in?
That is a topic of some controversy.
That's good for the show.
So, at least in my experience, it seems to be that gigging is often seen as like the easy way to get your limit of flounder. Get out there and get 10, 20, 30 fish in the boat, depending on how many people are there. But there is some controversy over sort of gigging being more of a like critical pressure on the fishery as opposed to the hook and line angling.
Gigging is a much more efficient method than hook and line. Whereas hook and line anglers, typically for a bag, they get one fish per angler. And that's a pretty good day, one or two. Gigging, we have a 5-fish bag limit, and a lot of them have no trouble hitting that.
Is the bag limit the same for hook and line and for gigging?
Same bag limit for recreational anglers.
Okay, okay.
Just more likely to fill it if you're gigging.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What is the perspective of flounder in Texas? Like, how is it regarded as a sport fish? Is it really important, or is it kind of a second-tier, third-tier sport fish?
It's, it's part of the Texas Slam, reds, trout, and flounder. But compared to reds and trout, flounder are a distant third place.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems to be like most people are only really focusing on them during that, that fall-winter run when they're sort of moving offshore to spawn. And like the Galveston Bay fishery for them is sort of historically famous as far as having a very good flounder run. And, if you drive over the bridge to the island where A&M Galveston's campus is on, November through sort of February, absent the time when the season's closed in December to let them spawn safely, you'll see people like lying in the roads, lying in like the seawalls on the side of the bridge, because the channel there is quite a famous flounder spot. People do go crazy for it then, but most of the rest of the year, yeah, they're kind of are playing second fiddle to the red drum and the speckled trout in the sort of trinity.
On. It's time for a minute with Maria, with me, Maria Dosal, calling in from Chogyang Lands here in Dillingham, Alaska. I wanted to give a big shout out to our guest, Kagasikun, for coming to speak with us on the Southern Flounder in honor of American Wetlands Month. If you can, take a trip to your nearest wetlands and bring a pair of binoculars, pack a picnic, go out, check out your local wetlands. take the time to go out into nature and enjoy all of the wetlands and all the fish.
Daniel, you probably know more about the physiology behind how fish taste than anyone else I know. So I'm curious how these fish taste.
Sure. So to anyone that's familiar with eating white flesh fish, you know, you're going to see two sides of the fillet, right? There is going to be part that's facing inwards away from the skin. That's usually going to be more sort of pure white, maybe light pink in color. Think of something like, you know, your cod, your snapper, your crappie. Then on the skin side, there's going to be sort of that darker meat. You know, it's going to look, usually going to look pretty red, maybe reddish brown when you have like a fresh fillet. And then as you cook it or as it sits in the fridge, it's going to kind of turn more grayish or brownish. That darkish meat is basically muscle tissue that contains a lot more of this pigment called myoglobin. Myoglobin is essentially what's used to store oxygen within those muscles. That meat is also going to have a much higher density of just various lipids. A lot of the muscle tissue of white flesh fish is going to be very, very lean. They don't store much intermuscular fat or oils. So how this actually matters for the flavor is that darker part of the meat is going to start getting more smelly much faster than the rest of it. It's going to contain a lot more sort of stronger, fishy, or often described as like muddy tasting compounds in there. And to follow on to that, that rich, like dark meat, is going to be much more prevalent in species that are sort of actively swimming around, swimming fast a lot, you know, something like your mackerels, your wahoo. Whereas in ambush predators that are going to be relatively slow moving, there's going to be a lot less of that sort of darker myoglobin rich meat. So something like a flounder, something like a cod or a grouper, usually going to be not really, you know, moving around fast very much. They're going to save their energy for those sort of short explosive bursts of movement to get their meal or escape from a predator. So they're going to have a lot less of that sort of fishy taste and usually are a lot more prized for the sort of mild flavor.
So if it sits still, it tastes good. Maybe.
Yeah. It tastes milder. Good is subjective.
Good to me is mild.
Yeah.
Daniel, when you prepare these fish, do you trim off that brown muscle?
I only really do that if it's a fish that has like a ton of it, you know, something like an amberjack or a mackerel. For something like a snapper or grouper or flounder, no, I don't really see much of a need to.
Okay. And while we're in this cooking theme, do you have a favorite recipe for this fish?
I am a born and raised Floridian. Have lived in Texas for about a year and a half now. And when I first moved here, knew that my study species was going to be southern flounder. I started looking into like, all right, what's like the classic, you know, northern Gulf, Texas, Louisiana way to do flounder. And I came upon deboned whole stuffed flounder, stuffed with a mixture of cornbread and crab meat and some bristol peppers, and made that with the first couple flounder that I caught after I moved here. And yeah, it's some of the better fish I've made in my own kitchen.
Nice. Okay. How about you, Mark? Do you like eating flounder? And if so, do you got a recipe you enjoy?
We have a very simple one where it's cooked the fillet in a lemon juice and flour, believe it or not, and butter, lots of butter. Because that makes
butter's always good.
And then once that's cooked, and they cook really quick because they're somewhat thin, it will deglaze the pan with some white wine and make a gravy out of that.
And
serve that.
Sounds fancy.
With rice and, you know, asparagus and that sort of thing. It's a very quick and very tasty, elegant meal, I think.
That sounds lovely.
How do these guys freeze? Are they good to freeze over time, or do they? I know some of the flounder we have up here in Alaska, they aren't good to freeze and you want to eat them fresh. Anything to say about this one?
I'd say they freeze all right. They're a little softer textured than something like, say, a red drum, which usually is going to result in less good freezing, but they are very mild, very lean. So they're not going to really develop any of those off flavors from those lipids and oils that you might get in something like a mackerel, which is another thing that makes fish sort of freeze not very well. I'd say that they freeze fine. Probably not the best that I'd say, but not far from the worst.
Okay. How are these fish doing? How's their population?
Severe decline.
Mm. Severe decline. But what are the causes, or what do you all know about it?
Well, it was a mystery for a while until we figured it out. But in the early to mid-90s, we started witnessing extreme declines in abundance. And that's in our fishery independent gears. And then they also declined in the recreational and commercial landings quite a bit. We didn't know what was going on. Everything was fine until early to mid-90s. Took us a while to figure it out. Until we discovered that the larvae of southern flounder are extremely temperature sensitive. They only have a very narrow window of water temperature that allows their survival, like between 16 and 20 degrees centigrade. If it's too warm in December, they won't survive. And that's the other side of the coin. If it's too cold in December, they won't survive. Has to be just right. And starting in, say, early to mid-90s, that's when we started seeing changes in climate. It stayed warmer longer, plenty of nice warm days in December, and it was just simply too warm for them. And that's why they are winter spawners, because their larvae require these cooler temperatures. But we're seeing extended warm seasons down here in South Texas especially. And it's just simply too warm for them in December when the larvae are coming into the bays.
Okay. Is there anything else affecting them?
Sort of an associated issue, not so much with the larvae, is sort of the sex differentiation. So males are going to be significantly smaller than the females. The legal minimum size for keeping a flounder in Texas is 15 inches. A lot of males will never get that big, even when they're fully grown. The females are a lot larger. So it means the females are much, much more like disproportionately represented and likely to be harvested, which can be an issue in terms of just overall abundance of eggs.
Can you tell if it's a male or a female when you have it in hand, or is there something more specialized you have to do?
The males are usually darker, right, Mark?
And smaller. Females grow a lot faster and larger than males. Actually, males rarely reach the minimum length, which is 15 inches here in Texas.
Okay. And is there something that's been done in terms of management to address these threats?
Oh, yeah.
Quite a bit.
We have a more restricted bag and size limit for the recreational fishery, even a closed season for the recreational fishery. Compliance is very good with some of our seasonal restrictions and bag restrictions, especially during the fall flounder run as they're going out into the Gulf. That's when they're most vulnerable to fishing. And we've been closing that season just to let as many flounder escape out in the Gulf to spawn as we can. In case conditions aren't right, we'll get a good year class out of it. We have a limited entry program for the commercial fishery. And another source was especially the juveniles were a component of shrimp trawl bycatch. Whereas shrimp are nets out in the middle of the bay, they would also catch juvenile flounder as well. We have a limited entry program and a license buyback program for the shrimp fishery. And the amount of commercial shrimping effort is a fraction of what it used to be. But until we start getting more conducive temperatures in December, these downward trends in flounder just they're not going to change.
Wow. Okay.
Have there been any discussions of hatchery efforts trying to produce these fish in a controlled temperature sort of environment?
Yeah. We've got an extensive hatchery program. The problem with flounder, though, unlike other fish, the more gallons of water, the more fish you can raise typically. That's not true for flounder.
Why?
When they settle out, they need surface area on the bottom. And they don't play well with each other. So you can't have too many laying on the bottom. They need their space. So if you try to raise too many in such a small surface area, cannibalism will take them.
Could you make like a tiered, like racks system within the water, or would that not work?
We have these little shallow, flat, large surface area tanks, these round tanks, to raise out the settled out flounder. Hmm. As soon as they start to settle out, you got to move them to a tank with lots and lots of surface area. And as I mentioned, temperature control is absolutely critical. The larvae, they're also very finicky eaters. We feed them rotifers, which we have to grow ourselves.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a big part of what I'm studying is some of the impacts on temperature as fish are growing. Some of the differences between just like 1 or 2 degrees centigrade in terms of how much it makes a difference on the early larval metabolism.
What are you finding so far? Or is it too early to say?
A little too early to say, but stay tuned.
May is wetlands month, so I did have some questions about salt marsh. It sounds like the temperature piece is a problem, but are there any threats to the marsh habitats that these fish are using at various stages in their life?
Definitely, yes. Development's always an issue when it comes to sort of critical coastline habitat. Beyond just the habitat that the salt marsh provides for other things, other big issue is that they are often carbon sinks. A lot of the sediment in those marshes is really, really old and really doesn't get sort of cycled up very much. There's a ton of carbon stored in there that gets released into the atmosphere when it is dug up. They act as like massive deposits for carbon dioxide.
Okay. Yeah, there's the Status and Trends of Wetlands report. It comes out every 10 years. And the most recent one that came out this year, it was saying that emergent marsh or salt marsh experienced the largest net percentage of in any wetland category. I'm curious how in the future that might compound with the temperature piece. You have the salt marsh being converted to more open water. What's that going to do to the flounder and some of the other fish we've spoken about?
Probably nothing good.
Well, we've got a lot of acres of salt marsh. As Daniel mentioned, the development is always a problem, but we still have thousands and thousands of acres, especially in South Texas. We still have a lot of undeveloped coastline here in Texas, and that's unlike some of the other states. You know, you see condos everywhere. That's what we're not observing here in Texas. We have little pockets of it, of course, but like the Laguna Madre and some other bays, they're just undeveloped, untouched.
Yeah.
Do you project that that's going to be the same going forward or with population kind of growth in the U.S.? I know up here, they've set up urban growth boundaries around cities in Oregon, but they're looking to change that just because they need places to put people. Do you imagine that these undisturbed wetlands are going to stay that way, or do you think they might get built up?
Well, we're doing what we can to help them stay that way. You know, Texas is one of the fastest growing states in the U.S. One thing that limits it is fresh water.
Hmm.
And in South Texas, fresh water is scarce. So that limits a lot of development. You simply can't get water to these developed areas sometimes. I'm here in Rockport. We're under water restrictions now just because our local reservoirs are so low.
Okay.
It's nice to be in a place where there is sort of an undeveloped coastline. You know, coming from Florida, the big issue there is not necessarily with the same salt marsh because we don't really get that same spartina grass in a lot of South to Central Florida. Mostly with the mangrove shoreline and seeing a lot of that sort of get lost to development. Nice to see that there is still a lot of unspoiled coastline in Texas. I did not know about the freshwater restriction. That is a very, very good factor to know about.
Yeah. It seems like these habitats, I mean, you can maybe look at the surface and see just grass coming out, but it's important to the shrimp and a whole bunch of different critters in the food chain that kind of really would be affected if there's major changes.
Huge for primary production, and also breaking down a lot of the biomass that gets flushed in from the bay. There's a lot of decomposition, small scavengers there.
Yeah,
I'd like to hear from Daniel more about your field work that you're doing because I love hearing about field work, and then from Mark talking a little bit about your fisheries independent surveys studying these fish.
Sure, my field work might be a little less exciting than some field work that you might get from other marine bio students. It's mostly at this point entirely. Within the hatchery is run by Texas Parks and Wildlife. I'm basically trying to find out if there is one, maybe two potential biomarkers that we can look at and assess very early on in that sort of like 1 to 10 to 15 day old age, where that single biomarker is going to be a very, very good predictor of how successful that entire batch is going to be when it actually gets released, or even how they'll survive in the hatchery before they get to that metamorphosis around 6 weeks old.
What is a biomarker?
Some kind of metric or endpoint that we can measure in the fish, you know, something like metabolic rate or their average swimming velocity or their cardiac output, something like that, that it's predictive of the overall health and growth of the fish.
How about you, Mark? How are you guys studying these fish out in the wild, seeing how the population's doing?
Well, we have a very extensive and long-running fishery independent monitoring program. We've been running these programs with a variety of gear since the mid-70s. We've been doing bag seines along the shoreline, and those target juvenile inverts and fish. We do open water trawls in the bay, and those target juvenile and sub-adults. And then finally, we have a gillnet survey along the shorelines, and those target sub-adult and adult finfish. But because we have such an extensive program that covers, in the case of flounder, generations of flounder, you know, we can very definitively say that the decline is real. And we can quantify it as well.
I remember I was writing out something for my PhD proposal and I found a figure from some kind of TPWD presentation. And then Mark came and gave a seminar at my school and I was like, oh, wait, hold up. he made this figure that I've been referencing for the last 6 months. in that same paper on the decline of the population since the 90s.
Yeah. How long have you been to a Texas Parks?
I just passed the 31-year mark.
Wow.
Congrats. Congrats.
That's cool.
I did want to ask, in these surveys, you're looking at more than flounder. Are you seeing the effects of warming winter temperatures on any other species that are living down in Texas, or is it mostly just the flounder?
That's really the only species that's in decline. We're seeing increases in other things. We're seeing more snook. Hmm. We're seeing more gray snapper. We're seeing more subtropical species moving up from the Caribbean and inhabiting Texas waters. When one declines, you gain something else.
I wonder if by the same virtue you're seeing, because you get southern flounder, of course, on the Atlantic coast as well. So I wonder if they're moving further up towards the mid-Atlantic and towards New England.
I also had a question, Mark. Are Gulf flounder more sort of tolerant to those warmer temps? I always found it weird that we never really got many southern flounder in like the southern half of Florida, but it was only the Gulf flounder.
Yeah, Gulf flounder seem to be intolerant of either warm or cold waters. And in Florida, you'll hardly see a southern flounder south of about Tampa or so. And that's when the Gulf flounder becomes more dominant, is from Tampa south. And we see the same thing here on the other side of the Gulf, where we see Gulf flounder in the southern part of Texas. We don't see them so much in the northern part.
Okay, so you're not having an overlap where anglers are potentially catching both all that much, or where Daniel's seeing juveniles of both and having to distinguish them.
Well, in Gulf flounder, don't get very big.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
You'll hardly ever see a Gulf flounder that's above our 15-inch minimum.
That's what I was going to say. In Florida, the minimum for Gulf flounder is 12 inches, so it's pretty rare to get one that's 15. That would be legal for harvest in Texas.
What's the max size the southern flounder can reach?
28, 29 inches.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Those are called doormats.
Okay. And how old would a fish that big be?
Well, they only live about 5 years. They're pretty short.
Okay.
Yeah, very short.
Okay.
It's a good point, because that's why we're seeing such a rapid change in the population, because there's so few age classes.
That makes sense.
Do either of you have any calls to action for anglers or the Texas public in terms of this fish or their habitats?
I'd say just generally, good practice is keep what you're going to eat. If you got a freezer full of fish, in my opinion, no reason to keep that full 5-fish limit every time, especially if you're gigging. You know, I do get it. You're putting time, you're putting money into the process, but the little guy's contribution can add up.
Cool. Well, thank you two for joining us. This was really neat.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Of course.
We'll get out there and live with, live from, discover and enjoy all the fish and help take care of those wetland habitats. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Iroh. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.